Yeah, thank you very much, Philip. It's always nice when people say nice things about you in the channel. It's lovely. Thanks very much. Yeah, I am Terry McDonough, and it's really nice to be back here in Cork. I have read before, remember, Paul, here and in the other. Where was the other building? What was it? Remember, there's a theatre attached to it and everything.
Yeah, the first 6 months. Was it the Cork Arts Theatre?
Cork, yeah. It was, anyway, there was a lot of chaos that night. There was a play being rehearsed in another room and a director coming out screaming at us and all this kind of stuff. So anyway, it's really, really nice to be here. I come from County Mayo, but I've lived in Germany for more than half my life, you know, and I'm moving back here again now. So I spent a lot of time in the last couple of years over here, working both in Ireland and different organisations in the country. So I am going to read. I come from the west of Ireland, County Mayo, and a place called Killeagon. And anybody who went to school and studied poetry in Irish would have heard of the word Killeagon, and that was the birthplace of the old poet Anthony Rafferty, the old blind poet of Killeagon. I was born in Killeagon as well. I'm very, very lucky. I have that tradition in my bones. I got it from my uncle and all kinds of people telling me stories and tales and legends about the old blind poet. And this old blind poet was born in 1778 and died in 1835. And he's buried in the County Galway in Killeagon Churchyard. When he was a little boy, about 10 or so, his family were struck down with smallpox. And now there were 10 children and 9 of them died. And he went blind. And he was taken care of by the local landlord, Frank Taff was his name, who sent him to hedge school. But when Rafferty was 24 or so, allegedly the story goes, Taff sent himself and another guy with a horse to Kilchimar to buy drink. And on the way, the horse fell into a ditch and broke a leg or a neck or something. And the horse, and he never, Rafferty could not return. He couldn't face the landlord again. And so he never came back. And that's where that poem, Anishchak and Ari Vilodal Hanchino, that the great, now with the coming of spring, they're getting longer and going to come back again. And that's where, that's his longing to come back to the homeland. Anyway, the reason I give all this spiel at the beginning is because I want to read a poem, Killeagon. It's one I wrote not so long ago, and it's never been published. And it's all about the area, and there's a couple of lines in here about, you know, one might find he ribboned Killeagon in red and black berries. Rafferty, when he was writing his great poem, he said, Tosmeras a Crivan, as Massagosor, there are all kinds of wonderful berries and tastes and everything else all around Killeagon. He was singing its praises. And this is called Killeagon. And throughout all of those seasons down to this moment, it is the pull of ordinary miracles, the independence of haws and slows, that calls me back to where I can breathe in roots, to where there's hardly a sound save for the silence of swallows, the winnowing of starlings, fog that tells you nothing, and foxes that build stealth into the fabric of time. A blind poet who ribboned Killeagon in succulent red and black berries found a way out, but never escaped. We have his word for it. Years ago, nature's spirits rose up in horror at the grim mathematics of moods when three men now departed tried to hack down a reluctant blackthorn to build a grotto in an open field. The blackthorn survived, but the tragic tale of the men sticks in the throats of those who dare to tell it. The oak, the ash, and the thorn, firm as stone-cold lips, stand guard against the harsh message of Roman gods. Bells ring and do what bells do in distant Kilchimar. Fathers, mothers, sons and daughters cry out in Camden Town. Seasonal moons tell us what we need to know. Farmers worry about silage or the lie of the land. And death cuts people adrift to float away like feathers to places that turn out right in the end. This is the order of things. Life circles us back to where we began, to my place, to my space, and we don't wonder at our luck. Words are raindrops that wait their turn to enrich living and landscape. And I stroll by hedges and rivers thinking happy things as my breathing grows smaller, as I wait to be transported to the silence of my ancestors. Thank you. So much for Caledon, and I'm going to move now to Germany, where I have lived for more than 30 years in Hamburg. And I had Matthew Sweeney, who lived here in Cork. Everybody almost knew Matthew in Cork here. He and John Hartley Williams, that great English poet, brought out a book quite a number of years ago, and it was entitled Death Comes for the Poets. And I was in Hamburg, so I jumped on the train because I had off. I knew Matthew really well, and we did a lot of work together in Europe and in Ireland. But anyway, I said to myself, I'm going on the train, I'm going to Berlin, I have to be at this launch. It was in the English Theatre in Berlin. And anyway, when I was going up the street, up in Kreuzberg, I was going up the street towards the theatre, I noticed this shop. I kind of thought it was a funny looking place. It was an undertaker's business. And there were all kinds of little surreal flashing lights and all kinds of weird things. I thought to myself, bloody hell, this is strange. I'm going to a reading about death coming for poets, and I see all this stuff there hanging round and urns and flashing lights and everything. So I thought to myself, bloody hell, what's this? Anyway, then we got to the reading and it started and everything else. The two boys were there. There was a small crowd, but the books didn't arrive. So anyway, this is called Out of the Dying Pan, Into the Pyre. In Kreuzberg, it's from Matthew Sweeney and John Hartley Williams, two lovely people. In Kreuzberg, Berlin, I was tormented by the thunder of hoofbeats on the pavement outside a coffin shop, on the same street as the theatre where fellow rhymers would be reading about death coming for poets. Inside the window, a skinny person on a pert office chair among slabs and urns was poised like an addict, waiting for a blast of incense in nominee patterns. Trying to pass myself off as a grim reaper, I pursed my lips flat on the glass pane and licked a scythe into the condensation. But he hardly gave me a glance, as if saying, I'm used to scared little men. Instead, he seemed to check me for height, weight, and lifetime at my disposal. His business comes in off the street. I was oscillating between life and half-life. A red heart above a vase flashed like a piece of karma, reminding me that reincarnation can be had on a recurring basis. I'd be this way again after the event, 2 hours older, with a signed book entitled Death Comes for the Poets. Mortals, owned for a time by caretaker parents, partners, relatives, then by an undertaker, by earth or flame. Parts of me have died already. Life is the castrator ripping the young beast out of us. The poets had been punctual, but the books didn't arrive. I had nothing signed to confirm that death came for poets, but was assured that words would enjoy a long and healthy existence after the demise of the pen. We drank to the mystique enshrined in language. Travelling home to Hamburg by train, I slept, dreaming of a journey in a coffin ship from Ireland to America, a time when death came for the hungry and nobody cared about readings at the English Theatre in Berlin or the shenanigans of a panicky poet outside a funeral parlour. I woke. The train slashed through towns and villages with lights going out one by one on this strange planet where we try to sing while poems are being honed by slinking foxes and gathering fog, by dozing cattle crying babies or outlandish people from other places. When I closed my eyes again, there were damp leaves and shades of death and life and windows to the North Sea, casually deliberating on the shaping of another day. Thank you. I read about a half an hour altogether. So I'm going to read from this new book now. It's called Fourth Floor Flat, 44 Cantos. And the book is in 44 sections. And I call them cantos because I think, you know, the old song, poetry somehow is related, is a song, should be. And there's a guy up here in the fourth floor, he's sitting up there. And I, in Hamburg, where I was living, where I've lived for more than half my life, I decided one day I was going to put somebody into a fourth floor flat. And I stuck him in there, this guy, this, you know, everyman, and all the thoughts and all his experiences and everything else, I'm sure they're mine as well, but they are, he lives them out in this fourth floor flat. And I was fascinated by the idea. And these days, when I'm in Hamburg, I jump on the bike and I cycle around and I look up at the flat and I wonder who lives in it. Because I put the man into that flat. And the people in there had no idea that a book of poetry came out of that flat at all. So I'm going to read a couple of poems, four or five poems out of this. And the first poem is in the third person because it just describes this guy leaving home. And like all of us, we all have to set out from home, don't we? And we have to tackle life, we have to take it on. In whatever shape or form it comes at us, we have to have a go and we have to put one foot past the other every day and try and make something out of it all. No? And this is called Setting Out. Before broadband here, there and everywhere, a long-haired youth slunk so far into foothills that he lost sight of home, and home lost sight of him. A glutton for pilgrim habits, he traipsed and tracked from land to land, village, seashore and city, chasing star after elusive star, dreaming from inside out, considering a bond with the devil and alien recipes, when he chanced upon a room, just a stone's throw from a voice in first person, yet far enough from the yowl and yelp of his home crowd. At first, he turned to his nag, wondering if it was best not to have an hour at all. But looking up at cloud pockets, sunsets, life and half-life, he knew he'd have to comment on the underbelly of fortune, if only to blame. And then suddenly, out of the blue, like a whole shebang of hammer and tongs and a gutful of pig iron, he blurted out from his high horse, I will, words are mine to speak. And so he set himself free on the world. And so I'll read a couple of more poems now. This time, they are in the third person. The first person. And the next one is, you know the way when you're in a flat on your own or a house in your own space, that you kind of, this is called on a roll. You sort of, you know, you look at yourself in the mirror or you sort of fix your hair a bit or you dance or something on the radio because there's no one looking. And this guy is on his own in this flat, but he's got a mouse as a friend. So the mouse is there in the corner of the flat, and the mouse sometimes peeps his head up and he talks to the mouse and goes around and he, you know, he dances and he looks at his shoes and the shoes look up at him. And so that's the way we all are, I think, aren't we, when we're alone and on our own. We're not always as perfect as when other people are around. And this is called On a Roll. Because I know it's there, I stroke my balding patch as my friend Mouse nibbles away in the corner in ways known to mice. I'm on a roll, radio on me, going full blast with versions of I can't get no satisfaction. Then, without change of pace, I snap my eyes shut, jump into a jig with a gaggle of geese and an academy of high-stepping hilltop antelopes, me twisting, jiving like a coy thing in my own space. Stop staring, Mouse! Come to my grove if you got jingle-jangle feet to jig on. I clap myself on the back, rile and yell a few times. Mouse has done with crumbs and left. I turn to my feet for guidance. They look up and I look down. We try an awkward alley, shuffle, routine sort of thing before diving into weed and fantasy. The starting gun won't give up. Tired as an old fish fighting tides, I plunk into a chair, place my flat hand on my jaw and pose, yearning to inhabit a house full of thoughts, formulae for an opus, knowing I'm no longer the youth I left wounded and short of guts in a field of fresh spuds. The flat of my hand still rests on my jaw. I proudly open the kitchen window to the disgruntle of a jackhammer, while down at the next corner a dead nearsighted violinist with eyes for heroes only scrapes a requiem to lost legions and rough wind. There must have been a hint of hope for him before battle and grimy time swallowed up his idols. But he will play till his terror fades into his playing. I pick up on his howl and shut the window. Now, another cup. This guy is a sort of a bit of a writer. You know, if he was around, he'd be here this evening, you know, doing his bit and trying to win the five-word poem and all the rest, you know. And he'd be very happy to be here, I think. And this next little one is called Disquiet, because he does therapies and he does all kinds of things, and he kind of fancies himself his chances with women, and he goes to the pub, but he does a bit of this and a bit of that, but he doesn't seem to be getting anywhere much, you know. At the same time, he doesn't seem to be on the dole. I don't know what he lives off. But anyway, this is called Disquiet, and he's thinking of himself, you know, as a writer, and maybe he could get a grant and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, Disquiet. Success is relative. My room is cozy. I'm on the top floor. No one above me. Any overheard noises, apart from jackdaws scrapping over worms, would be of concern. Disquiet is the word I'm searching for. As the city darkens, I hear thunder and see black cats staring as if I was a turtle on the run from raindrops. Cats and turtles don't pay rent, and a residence far out at sea is no solution either. Agents will never turn their backs on fat dinners by lapping shores or look twice at writers wringing their hands. Nor can I imagine one of them in a coracle at first light, armed with a lucrative contract to be signed by the messy of poetry, in exchange for a stash of cash and a haven beyond the reach of cranky critics. My heart changes pace when I think of reward. I did a sort of empty room echo reading in an art gallery for no money, and felt a spooky deja vu when the woman promised a crowd. She had a mailing list and I could sell books. Five showed up. I was the guilty horse in harness that couldn't pull a crowd. I sold a book and downed the profits in a gulp. Some milestones stand out like green wind in a boggy field. Would you like to read along the Baltic coast? Aye, said I. The first a pub run by a poet-loving person came to nothing. No way back. Life must go on, and it did, to an abandoned barge. At midnight, with blazing lights glaring me in the face, and a sparse gathering eyeballing and spaced out heavy metal raptures, my fee would be coming. It didn't. That story is really true, you know, because there was a guy in Hamburg, Lutz Hüttel is his name, and Lutz, he had a lot of contacts in East Germany, you know, so when the wall went and all that time after that, Lutz decided he was going to conquer East Germany with culture, you know, and so he organized, I remember we got up to Rostock anyway, the first, he had all a tour organized, Rostock. We got there, and when we got there, nobody knew about it, that was the first one. Then we went to this other place, this another sort of pub venture, and we discovered they didn't have a license for any kind of noise or microphone, so we had to go. And then we ended up at this big barge, way up on the, along the sea, on the coast, and it was as mad as a hell. And there was this lovely French woman with me, and we were eating together, and she was a gorgeous woman, you know, and she was totally confused, because all we had was all these guys with the full of dope and earrings, and they were all spaced out all over the place, and it was about 10 or 11 or 12 o'clock at night, and they put this blast of light on us and you couldn't read. Oh, it was terrible. But anyway, it was a great experience that I wouldn't miss out for anything. It was really, really something, you know. And so this is the way it is, you know. I'll just read a couple more from this, and then I won't, I promise I won't go on all night. There's nothing worse than a poet that goes on all night. I sometimes say, at poetry readings, I have a little snooze myself. I switch off when I work. And I hope that every so often you have a little snooze as well, at times when it gets too much. And this is called Reverie. It's a bit to do with writing as well. Reverie out on a spree. I'd never go to a coffee house to discuss solid food with a man who had just had his teeth extracted, or attempt to elaborate on the subject of sex change with a landlord if I hoped to have my rent reduced to manageable figures. Apropos figures, I wish you could be at this window to see a colourful figure serenading a flashy peacock. The bird seems content. Must be a hymn. joking apart. Fact is, city women with classy haircuts and pets that respond to foreign names get all the juicy platforms. I'm perfectly jealous. Could be the she in me aching for an outing. But stilettos are not the answer either, not even in bed. Can't see myself on a catwalk, and I don't think art does much except keep people thin. Even clenched fists do little to dispel the notion that thespians hang out in second-hand clobber, and that arty friendships are rooted in size, stature, and label. I had a literary friend who tried to borrow a pair of my shoes for a presentation one Sunday evening. Sorry, too small. We insoled his with cardboard against elements, and a master plan was obliged him to conceal his loafers under the table during his act. I took a front seat. The tablecloth gave cover to feet, buried and hidden as fresh coffins. Afterwards, we shambled off through thick and thin. Thank God for dark, said he, raising at last to the strength of the feet to come. Ditto. So that is so much for artists and everything. You know, I remember we used to play football. I was a drama teacher in Hamburg. And on Friday at 3 o'clock, a gang of us would get together and we'd go to the gym for a game of football and we'd kick the shit out of each other and everything else, get the steam of the week off, you know. That was a great old crack. I used to love it. Every Friday at 3 o'clock, straight into the gym. And then we'd go for a good few pints, and the whole thing was great fun, you know. And Hamburg is a great city at the time. Wow, action all over. But anyway, I remember one time going down to the gym, and there was an American bloke joined us, you know. And I heard him talking about his sweats. And I said to this English mate of mine, I nudged him, I said, Richard, what the hell are sweats? Am I thick or something? I never heard of sweats. He said, you must be thick. He says, Americans call tracksuit sweats. So I said, bloody hell, that's funny. So I decided this sweats in America deserved a little poem. I've heard tracksuits are called sweats in America. Perhaps I'd head USA way by a Cuba to stock up on sensible bottoms. There might be deals on rare bulbs to light up my page as autumn starts to strangle. Let's dream on till our feet burn. The auguries of longing are foolish, but cloud nine charm lies as sweet as ever on the road ahead. Hitching next to a funeral outfitter on a beef burger stopover along the Tennessee Trail, I get waylaid and horsewhipped for dismounting in uncool sweats and platform shoes. My nag winces at every lash on my frail back and jumps to my assistance with hooves flying. It's leave in a hurry or face a Trump-style hanging. We leave. My mind's not right, don't you think? Am I brainstorming a homage to my own demise? I hope not, for I cannot disappoint my steed or afford to dress properly for my execution. To say clothes makes the man is true and not true. I'm bewildered, but if I am, imagine how Hamlet must have felt about his costume when he realized it was his duty to kill his uncle. My prophetic soul, he said. We never did get to Cuba, but I do venture out in my old bottoms after dark. To avoid the sneer of blokes and hissing of tomcats out of hedges. Anyway, I'll read one or two more of this book and then I'll read one and we finish it. When did I start? I forgot it, my watch. I go for another piece. Yeah, this one is called Avoiding Tablets. There's another thing about therapy as well in here, and it's about, you know, about the guy doing the therapies and all this kind of stuff. And anyway, we won't go into that, but this is called Avoiding Tablets. Funny, we can't remember babyhood. All that pre and toothless stuff and not a trace left. Ah, for pity's sake. When a teenager went to the city with his mother, she let go, had to, with him shouting, it's not fair. She dodging the rain and they spinning. Come to think of it, I didn't allow my therapist this insight, but I did shout freedom and sang to myself out of the twinkle of an eye. Later, to avoid tablets, I signed up to a group session going round in circles on harp string songs, shilly-shallies and herbal juices. Loss of partner, gain of partner, looking at the moon, rounds of coquetry. I was the hair on the back foot, itching in the wind, when a pair of devastating eyes expressed interest in a flirt. Her partner had burst out to go to the dogs, gone pious, and I had come from a circus. I have, said I, sauntering. In general, I have nothing against sharing ding-a-ling, but breeze is breeze, wind is wind, and storm is exciting. I prefer my own scars. I imagine I must have feared erotic songs. Not that I begrudge eroticians their magical embrace, but I'd never be able to add fresh flesh to the laundries on the subject. I do like an occasional dream, coupling life with forbidden. It's harder to match up the living with the dead. I'd often get well canned, till street lights took me to littered up places, bitter sunrises, fecund deadly. A day in the life of a person freed up from restraints and tablets would be a great read. Imagine yourself hiding behind rusting scars, heaped up like silent scrap in a meadow. Thank you. I read a little bit, just a poem that means a lot to me. I'll read some of it. When I lived in Hamburg, I lived in a flat. I always lived in flats, you know. And I love flat life. You know, I far prefer it to houses, you know, because you don't have to bother with gardens and that kind of stuff. You know, and someone, you know, if the fridge breaks down, you get someone to fix it. You don't have to bother with that kind of daft stuff. But I was thinking, you know, about time, you know, time span and time, you know, that we've all got a little chunk of time and time passes. But there were two absolutely lovely people on the second floor, and they were really, really old, and they lived in the flat for 40 years. And, you know, they had two children that were grown up. They were late 30s, 40 or so. And they would talk, and they'd come round. But the day was coming fast when they couldn't manage the stairs. And it was so sad, because they told me all about Germany before the war, and all the stuff that went on, and we used to sit for hours just talking, really, about everything and anything. They were such nice people. It was awfully sad, you know, they left, they had to leave. Time span. Time is a floating shadow for some. For others, it means early or late, when you could be left sitting on your tree stump as confused as a crocodile on ice. My friend Mouse is happy with crumbs. With me on the sports page, my fingers stroking my chin, my mind humming to the fresh air of then, singing to the feel of now. The buildings across this street don't speak my language, yet they tell me of those who have drawn a bridge from then till now. Past, present, family nests. I close my eyes to see a new generation bursting through walls, charging this way and that to avoid the beaten track. The old sit on their balconies for a season before making way for fresh blood hiking up the centre of the street in the spirit of new shops. There's that circle again. Children find new names for footballers. Dads join in for a decade, and mothers gather up tears in their stride. Light kindling on the horizon bewilders for a time, then gradually draws and burns out. Sun peeps through rain and smiles on cold pavements. Trees soak up wet, plants shed and die. I cannot hear the voices of the past, but I know they're there in crannies. Bedclothes drape over balconies. Branches of families reach out to far beyond. An ancient warrior is a dead person, and dead is dead as long as it's allowed to be dead. Some, not forgotten, have their song emblazoned in the brick and fabric of this street. It is my street too. I own it with my eyes. I got a winged horse on my balcony and the promise of dry land on the far horizon. My universe embraces me where I am. This morning, an elderly couple, two floors down, told me they could no longer manage the stairs. They'd be moving to a home in a green belt. Time to go, they said, picking up their coats and weeping down every last step for the last time. 2 hours later, a furniture truck parked and a young couple could be heard laughing. It was a healthy laugh. They didn't realize they were about to trample on a lifespan. I see the old couple at the edge of a forest, wondering which way to turn for home. I like the image somehow, but it's a sad image. The sun rises and sets, but it won't let us in on its secrets. I'll read about two more pieces and then I'll stop because I don't want to go on forever. There's nothing worse than someone who drags. As I said myself, it's, you know, sometimes we need to switch off. But I, you know what, I wrote a book here a few years ago, the last public one I brought out, Lady Cassie Peregrina, and Cassie is a dog. And we have that dog in Hamburg. It's a beautiful border collie. And you won't believe it, there she is. She's a lovely thing. And she wrote half this book and I wrote the other half. That's fantastic. Because we were over here in Ireland for a year, and my son, who was not so little now, said he wanted a dog. I said, dog? Yeah, a dog. We had to go to Ballyhomes, to the rescue centre, to get a dog. And we got this lovely border collie who was very shy and had been kicked around a bit. But anyway, with a lot of tender loving care and everything else, we got the dog to jump into the back of the car and we fed her properly. But then, at the end of the year, we were going back to Hamburg. And Matthew, my little fella, said, I'm not going if Cassie doesn't come. So bloody hell, into the back of the car with the dog, and thrice 3 days driving with this dog in the back of the car heading for Hamburg, and we got there eventually. But I'm not going to go into it, obviously I could spend all night reading this, but Cassie has written a good few things about travelling. And I just like to read a tiny bit at the very end, and then I read one other poem, then I shut up. But this one is called The Full Circle, you know, and it has kind of come back. I've been away for a year, and I kind of was back and trying to find my way again. So I just read part of this, you know, Full Circle. I'm drinking coffee. Oh, sorry, there's one thing I mentioned here, the Alster. That's a lake in the centre of Hamburg. Beautiful big lake right in the centre of the city. I'm drinking coffee in die kleine Kanditerei in Osterstrasse, Hamburg, wondering how this journey began and how it might have been otherwise. The Hamburger Sparkasse on the corner looks after my money. I have a roof over my head and I have a family and some guilt to my name. Recently, I've been dreaming in German about a journey around a galaxy in a full circle from the west of Ireland to Hamburg and from Hamburg to the west of Ireland, and I can't get off. There are deep valleys, light, dark, and a wet sun smiling on a lake where spirits seem to congregate. I cannot see clearly into the lake, and no matter how hard I look, my own reflection just won't come up. You'd wonder about water. But there are things to be done. Cassie needs a walk and a morsel, and Matthew finishes school in a few hours. I always knew I'd have to travel, but there's an end to it. Well, isn't there? But no, there probably isn't. It's spirit to flesh, to earth, to bone. Now, months into eating hot and cold, a neighbour has passed away, and we cluster in our block like a clan huddling around last words. This morning on foot, I circled the Alster with a friend, marvelling at water, wondering if home was a matter of the heart in a no man's land of weeping, or not weeping in every man's land of spring. The full circle won't fill in. We don't own the intense and softer laughter of the wind, and even when I look harder, I cannot fathom the silence between horizon and horizon. Cassie is sleeping, quiet as incense, like a dreaming harp string in timeless ritual. Uplands call, flatlands call, somewhere a chord is struck in a symphony to a new season. Thank you. I read a poem, a kind of a light-hearted thing, and then I finish with a couple of very 3 or 4 short lines about love.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, it's good. Thank you.
I finished.
Yeah. No, 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 you're fine.
Am I okay? I'll
okay. Make you sure. Thanks, sir.
No, no, thanks. I wasn't sure. I didn't check the time, you know. I'm going to get carried away.
You're doing
and you've been listening
timing.
To yourself, you know. Nobody listening to yourself sometimes. You kind of forget because you're in. Imagine I'm able to talk here and nobody's contradicting me. When I'm at home in my own house, when I'm at home in my own house, I get dogs abuse out on this length of time. Do you know what I mean? But anyway, there was a guy came to Kajmar, and he came from America, and he didn't have Wi-Fi. And he'd be going around the place, sitting outside garages and outside houses. You could find him in a garden in the morning, doing his Wi-Fi, you know, because he didn't, and he was a mean old bugger, so he was always milking the system. He was the kind of fella who'd be robbing electricity of somebody else, you know, this kind of stuff. So anyway, I thought to myself, well, we have to sort of write a poem about this bloke, you know. And it's called Wi-Fi Poaching. When you overhear a person in a Mac shop inquiring about offers on milking stools, and if later you see them perched outside a garage with a gadget and looking shady and shrubbery, chances are they're Wi-Fi poachers, freeloaders, backpacking piggybackers, cuckoos relying on Mother Goodness to hatch an egg. Even worse, they might be tuning into matters intended for personal use or the confessional. If only football or racing results were at stake, you could live with it. But no, these people read in the light of a neighbour's window to save on electricity. Advice: have binoculars ready, and when Sponger's expression builds like a transgression, pull the plug on the router and listen for screams of rage. Put a sign up, try more, smoke signals, milk your own system. Knock on my door and allow me to introduce you to my wireless parrot, Polly. And what does that tell us? Nothing except Polly is a parrot, and it's unusual to see a person milking a gadget in a dark corner next to a garage after witching hour, and not a web or spider in sight. And now I'm going to finish with a couple of very short things here. You know, people often write love poems, and they're terrible. And there's nothing worse, because the only reason you write a love poem is because the object of your love is well and truly down the road, you know. So you'd be kind of trying to get her back if she had a few bob or a job or something, you know. So, basically, you know how it is, lads. And so I decided I'd have a bit of fun and I'd write a few love poems. True love. I knew a lovely lady who gave me a flower for my wall and a mirror for a ring. She had rooms full of silk and was as unfaithful as could be. But next mornings, when we sat blushing and glowing in perfume, she giggled because she didn't know where we belonged. Lady of Japan. I met a lady on a quay in Japan, and we never spoke a word. But we smiled and sang of lost love and of flowers in the spring wind. She pointed up to their mountain without as much as a whisper. I saw her people in colour, and she was a seaman's bride. I am not a seaman, nor do I ever want to be, but I met a lady on a quay in Japan, and we never spoke a word. Lovely women. I just read two other shorties, then I'm sure. Lovely women. Reuben's women were round and fat. Beckham's wife is very thin. Reuben's women are alive and well. With Beckham's wife, we cannot tell. And the last one is without words. Under a tree long, long ago, he was fat and she was thin. The tree came down one windy night. He got thin and she got fat, and rat-a-tat-tat, that was that.